Welcome to another episode of Up My Nursing Game, the podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. I am your host, Annie Fulton. Today, we will be chatting with Dr. Darian Reed, who is an oncologist finishing up her fellowship at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington. Joining us to discuss today's topic of neutropenic fever will be my fellow nursing colleague, Sinet Ali. Don't forget to claim your free continuing education credit for this episode by going to upmynursinggame.vcuhealth.org. All right, listen in. All right, welcome Dr. Reed and Sinet to the show. I'm really excited to talk to you guys today about neutropenic fever, as excited as one can be when talking about something that's kind of serious and somewhat of an emergency, but I can't think of two better people to talk to about this. Before we begin, Dr. Reed, please introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself, education, hobbies, and the like.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here. I grew up in Southern California. I ventured up north for college and then stayed up north, actually, across the bay, and did a joint MD-PhD program at UCSF. My PhD research was on signaling in triple-negative breast cancer, and my passion is breast cancer. And after completing my medical training, I went and did residency out at University of Arizona. And then I am now in the beginning of my second year of oncology fellowship at University of Washington and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And I'm just starting my research portion of that fellowship, planning and aiming toward a career as a physician scientist in breast cancer.
Wow. So we can call you Dr. Doctor then?
technically, yes.
That's awesome. That's amazing. You're still in your training, so to speak. Like, I don't know if you call it training, but I mean, it's a long path as an MD PhD.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. It's a lot of delayed gratification, as you say.
And that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And putting life on hold.
Yes.
To try to get to the end, to try to get to the point where one gets a real job.
I mean, one could argue you've had a real job for all of these years, but you know, when you're not in the hospital, you're not studying, you're not in clinic, like what are you doing with your free time?
I forgot about the hobbies part.
Right.
free time. Huh. Well, it is a newfound thing for me to have since I started the research time. Having weekends now is for the first time in 6 years is quite nice. There is an awful lot of hiking in the Pacific Northwest that I have only just started exploring. I haven't played soccer since COVID put that on hold, but have been a pretty serious soccer player most of my life, had a little bit of a break around college and then went back in grad school and then was playing pretty regularly again. So having not played in more than a year and being the age that I am, it may not be the wisest to just jump right back in. So, running is what I've been doing instead.
Okay.
And then music. I love music. I can't wait till concerts start happening. Again.
I like running too because, let me clarify. I don't love running, but I like it. When you have a busy schedule, right? Like it's so efficient. You just throw on some shoes and you walk out the door and you can start running. So
I maintain that it is the most efficient way of cardiovascular exercise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There you go. All right. Sinet. So Sinet is a coworker of mine and I'm so excited to have you with us today, Sinet. Introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here with both of you. Yeah. I think it's funny because Annie and I think we met really recently when we were just on a floor working together and you were telling me about your podcast and I got really excited about that. But, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Michigan. I went to school locally. I kind of stayed in that bubble, unfortunately, for probably way too long. Started my nursing career in Ann Arbor. I worked at St. Joe's and worked on the medical PCU for just shy of 3 years. So we saw a great variety of patients, but not to the level of which I've been sort of meshed into here at Stanford. I came out to California thinking I was just going to take a couple travel assignments and ended up staying. And I've been at Stanford since 2016. So I've been in the float pool for quite some time now, just maybe shy of 5 years. So I have respectively gained a lot of skill and knowledge really from everyone around me, physicians, residents, in training, nursing, everybody. So it's been great to have that experience under my belt now. But and I don't do too much in my free time. I feel like free time is kind of like scarce. I forget what things are like, but you say concerts. I'm like, I don't remember the last time I saw that or been to one. Really, with how crazy things are going on in the world now, I just sort of work out to stay sane. I was a soccer player in high school, which was a long time ago. But, I just try to be as active as I can. I'm very grateful for like the close friends that I have here. I travel back and forth to my family quite often, and that was kind of put on hold for a while. But yeah, I just sort of try to, every day is a new day, and I just do what I can with the time that I have. So.
Did you pick up any new hobbies during the pandemic?
No, I was certainly that girl who was like, let me buy a KitchenAid and I'll start baking. And I'm like, why would I do something like that, right? so I bought one and it's just been sitting on my counter for a really long time.
I see.
But it's there in case I want to make some bread or something. But no, I didn't. I stopped watching TV, which is kind of the opposite of what most people did. I think I just kind of was over what I was hearing very quickly. So I learned to really live in silence for quite some time, oddly.
Wow.
It's not something people would want to do, but I think I just keep it on for background noise and I just make a lot of phone calls.
Yeah.
That's what I do. Someone needs to talk to me.
I think I'm like the exact opposite of you, Sunette, because I think like in high school, I was, I don't know, like a little idealistic and I thought TV was below me. And, but ever since then, maybe it's because it's like quote unquote, the great age of television. Like I love watching TV.
Yeah.
And for me, like it is such a stress relief to come home and like watch an episode of Netflix. And like, I feel like it is so therapeutic for me.
Oh, it definitely is. And I think that I did that a lot. And I was like, maybe I'll try something new.
I think I'm still not very good at figuring out, or I should say still trying to find the right balance of how to turn my mind off from work stuff if I don't mm-hmm. have something actively distracting me. And
yeah.
I haven't figured out how to quiet my mind on my own. Aspiration.
Yes. Yes. And especially like, gosh, I think having a kid helps a lot because they're very distracting. But I had difficulty doing that like at the beginning of COVID, like coming home from like, especially the first few months during COVID when everything was really scary and there were shortages and we didn't know what we were doing. Like the only thing I could come up with was like having a glass of wine when I got home. That's how I quieted my mind.
Mm-hmm. I mean, don't get me wrong. I use that too. usually beer, but yeah.
All right. So today we're going to talk about neutropenic fever. Dr. Reed and I kind of landed on this topic today because, you know, we were thinking about, okay, what are some common presentations we see of oncology patients at the hospital? She and I decided that neutropenic fever really makes sense because it is such a common hospital presentation. So Dr. Reed, take it from here. Like, what is neutropenic fever? I realize it's kind of all like in the name there, but could you walk us through what exactly neutropenia is and what constitutes a fever?
Yes. So there is actually a very specific definition. We can start with the neutropenia side of things. So neutropenia meaning low neutrophils. Neutrophils, of course, are a subset of the white blood cells. And the definition is it can vary, but usually the cutoff is less than 500 cells per microliter is the definition of severe neutropenia. And then the definition of fever in the setting of neutropenic fever would be a one fever documented of 38.3 degrees Celsius or two separate measurements at least an hour apart of 38 degrees Celsius minimum. And so if you meet both of those criteria, I should say there's also sort of a asterisk in there of you can have the fever and your neutrophils are on the way down and they are expected to drop below 500 within the next 48 hours. You also meet criteria for a neutropenic fever. And this is one of a handful of oncologic emergencies.
Okay. And for those who think in Fahrenheit, I'm doing a quick calculation here.
Oh, yeah. 38, I know, is 100.4.
Yes.
38.3 is probably close to 101.
Let me do it here. Mm-hmm. 101.
I think it's 101.3 or something along those. Yeah.
Google is telling me 101. So at where you work, Dr. Reed, it's 38.3 is the cutoff, like a one-time temperature of 38.3.
Yep.
Okay.
So that cutoff is set actually by a number of the societies that formally make recommendations on how to treat it, a bunch of the oncologic and hematologic societies that our field of hematology and oncology, you know, looks to for guidance. They set this as the definition. It's the accepted, I'm sure some expert panel came up with it once upon a time.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit more about how you measure neutropenia? Like, are we talking about ANC levels? Or are we just strictly talking about neutrophils?
So the number of neutrophils is the absolute neutrophil count. That is the ANC. So when we say ANC, that literally stands for absolute neutrophil count. And that is the number I'm referring to of being 500 cells per microliter or less. So it's a subset when you get a differential on a CBC. You need to see the different subsets of white blood cells. And it is one of those, the PMNs or neutrophils.
Okay. Okay, so neutropenia is when the ANC is 500 or less.
Or on the way down and expected to drop below, for the purposes of neutropenic fever.
Okay. So how would you know if you're expecting it to go down?
Yeah, good question. So in our field, we do that a lot when we give people chemotherapy. It can be pretty it follows a pretty predictable course of, especially in acute leukemias, when we are giving really, really strong chemotherapy regimens that are toxic to the bone marrow, we know that they are going to have actually zero neutrophils for weeks often.
Got it. So leukemia patients can have zero neutrophils, but what about, every other kind of cancer? What are we expecting from them in terms of like neutropenia?
Yeah. So the regimens used for the acute leukemias and as what we call conditioning regimens, which are to prepare the bone marrow for a stem cell transplant, are the most bone marrow toxic. There are some other solid tumors that have some moderately intense bone marrow toxic regimens, and then some that we don't really see very much neutropenia with, some solid tumors and some chemotherapy regimens. It really depends on the specific drug and the specific dose of that drug.
Okay. So we're obviously talking to an oncologist today and of course, a lot of your patients are undergoing chemotherapy, but are there any other causes of neutropenia besides chemo?
Yeah. So, interestingly, most causes of neutropenia are drug related. Now, that's not always chemotherapy, though that is a very common kind, but you can get drug induced neutropenia actually with a lot of different drugs. If you actually go look, various anti-epileptics, lots of antibiotics, a lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily think about, some antivirals, PPIs, proton pump inhibitors.
Ooh, really? We give those out like candy at the hospital.
Is that like long-term use? Are you saying more so than just sort of like a short
period? You'd be less likely to see it right. with a few days. While we don't entirely understand the mechanism behind these types of drug-induced neutropenias, it's probably partly immune system related. And right. we think that people probably have some sort of propensity, mm-hmm. but it doesn't take, you know, people can drop within a week or even days. Actually, one of the most classic examples is there are a bunch of psychiatric medications, specifically clozapine. I don't know if you guys have interacted with that mm-hmm. at all. It's sort of an old school medication that is maybe being used a little bit again now. It has this known risk of severe neutropenia called agranulocytosis, but it's still like one of the best psychiatric medications for refractory mm-hmm. schizophrenia. So that's a case where I've seen it in the last year. A young patient who was started on clozapine, and within 2 days, his neutrophils had dropped very, very seriously.
So this is kind of a funny question, but as an oncologist, are you ever consulted on patients who, like this one you just described?
Yeah.
Even though he obviously doesn't have like an oncologic process going on, but he's experiencing neutropenia.
Yeah. So that falls under the purview of hematology. So while I am single boarding in medical oncology, the most people do both hematology and oncology. And so the fellowship is mostly built for people doing both. And so while there are some hematology rotations that I don't do that are hematology only, there are several inpatient rotations, for instance, at our local VA and at the local county hospital where we do both hematology and oncology consults. So I did both of those things. And a lot of the hematology consults for sick, you know, inpatient consults for, you know, ICU and med-surg and whatnot are for low platelets. That's a really mm-hmm. common one. And low neutrophils and cloth.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a large number of patients too. You can see half the hospital with that. But what about like autoimmune disorders? Are they like prone to neutropenia?
Yes, you can see some of that. There's something called Felty syndrome, but you can see essentially autoimmune degradation of neutrophils. And again, like I said, there is believed to be some immune system component of mm-hmm. even the drug-induced neutropenia. Somehow your body ends up making antibodies potentially to the drug linked to something else or the drug on one of your own presenting cells. Somehow something gets triggered that your own body ends up attacking. There are a couple. I mean, you can see it with Still's, adult onset Still's disease. So yes, you can see it. It's not as common as drug-induced neutropenia.
All right. So safe to say that chemo is like the number one culprit of neutropenia. Although it sounds like we could, you know, also see it in these hematologic disorders as well.
Correct. We do it iatrogenically most of the time.
Okay. And that means drug-induced, right?
That means, it means that we have done it to the patient.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like there's some pretty like black and white guidelines for working up neutropenic fevers here. Darian, I know a lot of this is like physician heavy here, like deciding whether to keep a patient like in the hospital or letting them return home. But could you talk briefly about like that initial decision to keep a patient in the hospital? Like who as bedside nurses are we going to see in the hospital?
Essentially, the simplified way of sort of segregating it is that there are some scoring mechanisms, and then sometimes it just comes down to clinician, I guess, judgment of who is stable for trial in the outpatient with very close follow-up and who needs to be admitted. And certainly there are things that are known to be high risk. So one of the situations that we see a lot, for instance, is that we put our acute leukemia patients and our bone marrow transplant patients that we know are going to be neutropenic for, you know, weeks, we put them on levofloxacin or another antibacterial prophylactic to try to prevent neutropenic infection. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody develops a neutropenic fever while on levofloxacin, for instance, you are no longer a candidate for outpatient therapy usually, because we presume that you've got something that, you know, has beat the levofloxacin, which is already a strong antibiotic.
Maybe now is a good time to talk about solid organ versus hematologic disorders. And that's something that I actually hadn't thought about until I spoke to you recently. Yeah, if you could just speak to that, like, why are you concerned more with these hematologic cancer patients versus solid organ?
Yeah, so when somebody has acute leukemia, the goal is to get them in remission, essentially. And this goes for as well myelodysplastic syndrome, AML, ALL. And a lot of these patients, of which will go on to undergo a bone marrow transplant. But our number one goal from the beginning is to get them in what we call remission, which means that we cannot detect any cancer cells anymore in their bone marrow by any of several methods of detection. And so the best way that we know to do that still at this point is to just give lots of chemotherapy that is very toxic to the bone marrow. And so we know that in order to get a shot at cleaning all of the cancer cells out, we have to give so much chemotherapy that they will have essentially no blood count for several weeks. And this is as opposed to most, if not all, solid cancers that our goal is not actually directed at the bone marrow at all. As far as we know, that doesn't help us treat the tumor. Our goal is actually to at the tumor cells in the solid tumor, not in the bone marrow. And the toxicity to the bone marrow is more of a side effect. It's not what we're actually trying to do. And so some of the regimens, and I will say that also some people give two people the same amount of the same drug, and some people's neutrophils may bottom out and some people's may be fine. The biggest risk with solid organs is usually on the first cycle when you're seeing how somebody may respond. And if you've really obliterated their neutrophils or their platelets, then often we will dial it down with the next cycles, because that's not our intention, and we don't need to be that bone marrow toxic with the solid tumors. And so it's a necessary thing to pass through for those leukemia and transplant patients. And the risk of neutropenic fever and neutropenic infection is related to the duration of time that they're neutropenic and the depth of the neutropenia. So do they have zero neutrophils? Do they have 500? These things make a difference. And so by the fact that they have zero neutrophils, often for weeks, the leukemia and bone marrow transplant patients are the highest risk. And I think it's something like 80% of patients who either go through in what we call induction chemotherapy for acute leukemia, trying to get that remission, or what we call conditioning, cleaning out the bone marrow before a transplant, 80% of patients that go through either of those will develop a neutropenic fever. The rates for solid tumors are much lower.
Yeah. So you're saying that leukemia patients, by and large, they have a longer duration of neutropenia and, on top of that, more profound neutropenia than solid organ transplant.
That's correct.
Transplant, sorry. Solid organ cancer. Okay.
That is correct.
So my mom was had leukemia and 6 years ago underwent a stem cell transplant. So I guess this topic is very near and dear to my heart. And something I'll share in the show notes here is a picture of a calendar that was kept in her room in the hospital where they posted her white blood cell count and her hemoglobin count every day. And I don't remember her ever getting the zero white blood cells. And, you know, I'll just throw in the caveat here that I don't think we were looking at neutrophils. We were just looking at white blood cells as a whole. But it was less than 0.1 for a few days.
So actually what you're saying, less than 0.01, is actually how at my institution that it shows up in the labs when we're at zero. So
yeah, It's the same, actually, at Stanford as well. And I think, Annie, did you say your mom was, I'm not sure where she was, her treatment was, but I'm very familiar with the calendar you're referring to. Mm-hmm. And it's in every room, and they're, you know, patients actually really enjoy making sure that that gets filled out to sort of see where they are treatment wise and their families as well. But I actually had a friend who, if I recall correctly, had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she presented obviously like a single sort of tumor, and going off of what you've explained and really clarifying that and making a lot of sense of it. She obviously didn't experience the neutropenic fevers. And I mean, obviously her journey was much different, but it sort of makes sense when it's described and explained in the way that you have, because in a lot of ways, I think when we think like of treatments, we see and we hear a lot of the same chemo regimens happen. And I think what's confusing so much on a nursing end is not so much for people, for the nurses who are chemo certified nurses who do it on a regular basis, but for those of us like Annie and I who kind of go in and we're kind of hands off in that sense. It's, oh, it sounds familiar and I've associated this with this and that makes sense. But I think on a BMT front, for those who are inpatient, who are already on these antivirals and antifungals and just every type of medication and who still spike these temps, it's some of the most frightening things to watch, because you're almost like, okay, well, from this point forward, what do? We're checking, you know, blood cultures again. Are we doing a urine sample again? Are we doing x-rays again? What diagnostics are we getting into and where do we go from there?
Dr. Yeah. Reed, like, let's talk about like, how are we working these patients up?
Yeah. So sometimes, as you pointed out, they're coming from clinic. Mm-hmm. We keep a very tight leash on these patients. And sometimes they're calling the clinic saying, I have a fever. And sometimes it is actually quicker for us to bring them either to the clinic, or we have a acute care evaluation clinic in our cancer center, which is the outpatient cancer center. So they'll either be directed to somewhere at the cancer center or to the emergency room. And I will say that often, like I said, it's quicker. We know that we can get labs drawn and blood cultures drawn and the first set of antibiotics given, like we like to do, all within an hour. That really mm-hmm. is the gold standard of them. Well, ideally from the first fever, but often that doesn't quite happen, but certainly from hitting the door. Mm-hmm. So that is, even in a busy emergency room, that is still the goal. And again, the blood cultures, it should be two sets. If they've got any sort of indwelling port or central line, one set should be from there and the other set should be peripheral. And then, usually, and again, to some degree, this depends on institution and resistance rates around your institution, but usually the go-to is cefepime if a patient is going to be admitted. And then sometimes with additional antibiotics like VANC, if you're worried particularly about a gram-positive, for instance, a skin or a line-associated infection where you might have a staph situation. And then in terms of other workup, certainly chest imaging, at the minimum a chest x-ray. If there are any respiratory symptoms, very, very low threshold is to go ahead and get a CT scan. We're always asking these patients about any sinus symptoms, also low threshold to get a CT maxillofacial to look at the sinuses. And then GI, such a common side effect of all the chemo we give, people often get mucositis, which mm-hmm. in the mouth, of course, leads to sores and skin breakdown, which can be a source of bacteria from the mouth. But then further down in the gut, something called typhlitis. Essentially, if you have mucositis and down in your colon, you can get little microscopic holes, essentially similar to ulcers or lesions in your mouth. And you can get translocation of, like, transient translocation. I'm not talking about a huge hole, but transient translocation of gut flora out of the GI tract and into the bloodstream. And then another place that it is really important to examine carefully in neutropenic fever patients is the perirectal area. Because if people have, you know, hemorrhoids that have at all become infected, or any sort of lesions, skin tears, abscesses, that is a not uncommon location of infection. And then certainly if they have a line, need to look at the line, make sure there's no redness, swelling, warmth. And then any neuro symptoms, very, very low threshold to get brain imaging and or tap, spinal tap on these folks. Of course, you would want to make sure platelets in that instance were sufficient.
Right, right.
And then skin in general, as I mentioned, any sort of skin or soft tissue infection can also be a source. But I think the statistics these days are that the vast majority come from the gut. That is believed to, by and large, be the biggest source.
Is that different from like a GVH type for patients who have been transplanted?
So GVH is essentially a mucositis mediated by your own body attacking it, but that can set you up for having a gut translocation. So you can be, you can get an infection that is secondary to GVHD. And of course, in that situation, you may have a patient that's on steroids, which is very common after transplanting with GVH, which may further suppress their immune system and complicate things, and they can get quite sick.
What are you looking for if you want to do a good neuroassessment on these patients and perhaps check their CSF? Like, are you talking like meningitis? Like, what are you looking for here?
Yep. Yeah. Meningitis. The dreaded is, would be, so fungal infections are always the most dreaded complication here. And unfortunately they do happen, especially in our leukemia and transplant patients. The most common place for them to happen is in the lungs, but they can spread to the brain. I have seen that where a gentleman had some neurologic symptoms and his brain was scanned and he had several, what turned out to be nocardia, which is not, not an infection you want anywhere, but is devastating in the brain.
So what about fungal infections are particularly worrisome?
They are very difficult to treat. We have a, you know, a limited number of antifungals at this time. We desperately need more. The best one can, for several different types, including, I believe, nocardia, is continues to be amphotericin, which is pretty toxic. And it doesn't, it does, just doesn't work that well. A lot of them can slow down growth, but are not as good at killing. And they can, for instance, like, nocardia or mucormycosis, that whole family of rhizopus of, fungi, the best and pretty much only way to treat it is surgically. You have to cut it out.
Wow.
So, I mean, and I have seen, you know, taking out a lobe of a lung just to try to clean it out. But of course, if you're in a situation where fortunately it's gone to the brain, it's not so easy.
Actually, one of my friends is a mycologist, which essentially means she studies fungi. My mom eventually developed a fungal infection in her lung. So my friend who's a mycologist explained that fungus are more related to humans than they are to bacteria.
That's right. That's correct. And so it's difficult to find and develop new antifungals. I'm sure there are companies doing it, but there's a very narrow window, therapeutic window there, where you're not having activity against human cells, but you are having activity against fungal cells. It's much more difficult than for bacteria.
Let's talk a little bit about like the prophylaxis regimen that some of these chemo patients are on. I see, I often see like Bactrim, acyclovir. Like, can you just talk about some of the prophylactic regimens that we can expect to see for these neutropenic patients?
Yeah. So aside from neutropenia, the I would say again, this is usually seen in the leukemia patients and the bone marrow transplant patients. If they will always check the serum to see if the patient has had HSV1 or HSV2. If going into transplant, they also will check CMV, as well as VZV and sort of take note of what viruses could reactivate in this patient if you immunosuppress them. And so then we're trying to prevent that from happening, because when you take away the immune system, you could easily have one of these viruses take off with being in check with a regular immune system. So the acyclovir is usually targeted at HSV. And then the Bactrim, you will see not only on patients who are on steroids, because patients on steroids are at very high risk of PCP pneumonia, but also in our prolonged immunosuppressed patients, leukemia patients, we'll get Bactrim for PCP prophylaxis. And then fungal prophylaxis depends to some degree on the patient's fungal history. If they have any history of lung nodules, even, we'll take that very seriously and sort of assume the worst and assume that they may have a lung infection in there, a fungal infection in there. And then also, I will say that this can vary from institution to institution, but something like fluconazole is very often, and that's mostly aimed at candida. Sometimes in leukemia and transplant patients, they prefer posaconazole that has a little bit more activity against some other fungi, not as good against candida. So that varies a little bit where you are in institution. And then, as I mentioned, bacterial, right now, the most common bacterial prophylaxis is levofloxacin.
So for the patients that have been in the hospital who are initiating chemo, for instance, what length of time do you think or most often happens before you start to see this when you initiate chemo? Are they mostly in the hospital when that happens, or is it typical at all for them to do relatively well inpatient and then go home and then sort of experience these complications?
Yeah, good question. So we tend to see the neutrophils drop about a week after we give these huge doses of bone marrow toxic chemotherapies. And then this definitely varies from institution to institution. Some institutions, if you're going to have, you know, if you have acute leukemia or you're getting bone marrow transplant and you're going to get these really big regimens, you will remain inpatient until your accounts recover.
To bring this back to like bedside nursing a little bit, like I have a few questions for you. It sounds like there are like a lot of things that a bedside nurse should expect with a patient who is hospitalized with neutropenic fever. One that you brought up that I hadn't really thought about is the fact that this patient will probably be profoundly anemic as well, and that we'll have to keep a close eye on their hemoglobin levels and anticipate like blood transfusions. Is that right?
Yeah. So especially with the regimens that we give, again, to these acute leukemia patients and the bone marrow transplant patients, the regimens that we give are toxic to the whole bone marrow, again, by design. And so all of the cells that give rise to all of the lineages are just wiped out. And so we essentially support them with transfusions for weeks.
So not just red blood cells, but perhaps like platelets as well?
Yeah. Correct. They often need both.
Is there a role for like Neupogen or Epogen in these patients?
Yeah, so that's a good question too. So that becomes a bit of a double-edged sword in somebody who you're trying to clean out the bone marrow of. Because especially, so I will say, especially with AML, acute myelogenous leukemia, the neutrophils are a subset of the myeloid lineage. So you could theoretically imagine if you're giving G-CSF to stimulate the myeloid lineage that you would worry about giving growth factor to cancer cells.
Right, right.
And G-CSF, just to clarify, is like the generic term for like Neupogen, like a medication that stimulates production of white blood cells.
Yes. So the generic name is filgrastim. G-CSF is the name of the hormone, essentially, that your body makes, that they now make in companies called filgrastim. It's the G-CSF stands for granulocyte colony stimulating factor. So it's the growth factor for these stem cells in there, essentially.
Okay, bringing this back again to bedside nursing, we're talking about like what to expect. what do we need to look out for in these patients? Like, what are some like very key assessment findings that we need to communicate to physicians?
Yeah, so any changes in vital signs is often the very first predictor. This one that I don't know how else to describe it other than nursing instinct, but when, you know, a nurse comes to you and says, this patient, something is wrong with this patient, like something has changed. They just have that, you know, they just know. You take that seriously 100% of the time. Yes. I think one thing that I will say that is so important is accurately documenting a neuro exam. Because if somebody has, you know, say they've had a distant stroke or, you know, they've had Bell's palsy, something small like that, that, you know, may not get documented all of the time. It's so important to make sure that's accurate, such that, you know, whoever comes on after you, whether it's the next physician, the next nurse, if they look at something and they're like, wait, is that new or is that a change?
Right, right.
That's one that I think gets drops through the crack a lot. And physicians are just as guilty of that.
Right. I think there's also so many things that play into that, right? Is it medication induced? Is it, you know, chemo sort of just taking it out of you? But yeah, again, it's sort of where in between these treatment times or what's most alarming that we should be looking out for and being vocal about.
Yeah. I think any change in mental status is another one at all.
Yes.
That should be taken seriously.
That's so interesting that you said like, that you're really pushing for a good neuro assessment, because I would have sworn that you would say, I want a good skin assessment on this patient.
I mean, I think the skin assessment, I don't want to downplay that in a neutropenic fever patient where the source could be from the skin and it could show up, you know, after they're admitted. But I think the chances, and I may regret saying this, but the chances of a skin exam changing suddenly are lower than a neuro exam changing suddenly. And that's something that we would not want to miss.
That's a really good point. And what about like stool assessment too, like changes in stool?
Yep. Oh yeah. I didn't even think about that. That's a whole conversation as well. All patients. It's one of the things that the whole team, when we round every day, we want to know how many stools. Are you having bowel movements? Are you having too many bowel movements? What do they look like? Have you seen any blood? All of these things. Because as I mentioned, all of the chemotherapies that we give, they can all cause constipation and they can all cause diarrhea. And the same drug and the same person can cause both and go back and forth. And so we spend a lot of time managing stool. And so, yes, we want to know about that too.
I have to admit that sometimes I have a little bit of trouble asking those questions in our oncology patients, because oncology patients really range the age span, right? Like you can get young oncology patients, you can get middle-aged, old. And, you know, talking to a, you know, 20-year-old male about his bowel movements and wanting to do a head-to-toe assessment of his skin and his anal area, like that's not something that is terribly comfortable for me. I'm just going to be like really honest about it, but it sounds like something that like I have to get over in order to provide, you know, really the best care to a patient who is experiencing neutropenia.
Absolutely. I think doing a thorough head to toe skin exam once at least is important. And then certainly if they're, because I guess the, you know, the flip side to that is they also may not want to have that conversation and they may not tell you that they've got this fissure, this anal fissure, or this, you know, perirectal abscess or this hemorrhoid that's been bleeding. And so, yeah, somewhere along the way, I stopped being shy, certainly about
same.
I've got no problem asking anybody about their bowel movements.
Yeah. You kind of have to be, you have to kind of sort of add humor if it's tasteful and like sort of fits the environment, right? Right. And even if it's the simplest, I mean, I know that I've had patients who are, you know, of any age range, but don't want to shower every day. And I know that sounds like a very simple thing for most people, but it is insanely significant for these patients. or, you know, oral care. Yeah. You know, what does your foot look like today? What are you feeling today? And just those, what may seem minor to some people, I think sometimes they need to be reminded that we're not just asking for the sake of asking, but it's just sort of that piece that we can just sort of continue that conversation.
You know, I had a patient recently who had like persistently low hemoglobin, who was a very educated, older male. And we kept asking, is there blood in your stool? Is there blood in your stool? And he said, no, no, no. He was swearing up and down. There was no blood in his stool. And I said, okay, we'll prove it. You know, like, I'm going to put a hat in your toilet and don't flush. Like, I want to see it. Like, I don't mean to be gross, but this is like clinically important. So he called me. He put on the call light. I came to look and it was black tarry stool. And he says, what? I was looking for blood. I was looking for red.
Yeah.
And it was like such a teaching moment for me that like, yes, he needed that education part. And when his wife was on the phone, she had this like great way of communicating with him. Like, honey, I know like you're a very smart man, but I just want to make sure you understand that ... Yep. And I learned so much from that patient. Like, you can't assume that someone knows what to look out for. And so like often what I'll say to my patients for whom like I keep asking questions about their stool is like, hey, you know, like Sunette, you were saying, like, try to make light of it a little bit.
Right.
Talk about like, hey, I know we're kind of a little obsessed in the hospital about stool, but, you know, it's important because X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And I know this is like not fun, but I'd like you to, you know, leave it in the hat and let me take a look at it.
Yeah. Another thing, that this sort of bleeding made me think about is that in our young women patients who are going through these intense chemotherapy regimens and getting thrombocytopenic with low platelets, their periods can actually become a real serious bleeding issue. Mm-hmm. That is another thing. So that's the thing you might see on the inpatient side. And often we will, if we're having issues with them losing too much blood, as I said, often we're having to give them transfusions of blood anyways, we will suppress, involve OB-GYN and try to suppress hormonally their periods.
This might be a little bit
That's where young women can lose a lot of blood.
This has been a really great discussion, honestly, like not just the clinical stuff that we've covered, but also like the communication part of it. Dr. Reed and Sunette, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Check out the show notes for more information about what we just talked about at upmynursinggame.com. Please help me grow this podcast by telling your friends and colleagues about it. You can also become a member on Patreon. All right, that's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game. The views expressed on this podcast and its media platforms are solely those of the participants and not their current or past employers. Please always follow your state's Board of Nursing standard of care and your institution's policies, protocols, and procedures.